You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, February 2nd, 2022. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal, the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Kyle T. Mays, assistant professor of African American studies at UCLA, author of An Afro-Indigenous History of the United States. Also on the program today, Democrats lose majority in the Senate temporarily. Hopefully temporarily. As Lujan had a stroke. Meanwhile, Josh Hawley calls on Biden to drop support for Ukraine membership in NATO, breaking with the rest of the Republican Party. Native tribes reach a $590 million opioid settlement. And we're number one, ladies and gentlemen.
We're number one!
U.S., the United States of America, has a far higher COVID death rate than other wealthy countries around the world.
Let's go!
American exceptionalism at its best. GOAT! Pfizer applies to the FDA for two-dose vaccine for children under five. Tesla recalls 54,000 cars with full driving software because they lack full stopping software.
And they determined that on our roads, where they're beta testing.
Why not?
Human dummies.
Hunger crisis hits Nigeria. Former Miami Dolphin coach Mike Flores.
Brian.
What?
Brian Flores.
Brian Flores? What happened? Leads a class action discrimination suit against the NFL. And Whoopi Goldberg. Is it Whoopi?
Yeah.
Suspended over her Holocaust remarks from The View. All this and more on today's program. Why did I say Mike Flores?
I don't know. I don't know who Mike Flores is.
I don't either.
Sounds like a Republican.
You should know Brian Flores.
I know Brian Flores, the former head coach of the Dolphins.
And before that.
Pats,
yeah.
Not the head coach. Offensive.
Solidarity with Brian Flores, who is risky. He may never coach in the NFL again. The NFL doesn't like it when you sue them. But
there was a football player called Mike Flores.
I was thinking of that guy.
But, like, I just hope that everybody learns from what happened with Kaepernick and supports Brian Flores here. Yeah.
Yeah, Brian Kaepernick was great.
Did I say that?
No. I'm joking. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for joining us today. We've got a lot to get to. We pre-taped Kyle Mays' interview just moments ago, so we will bring that up shortly. This study of how we rate against the rest of the wealthy world by the New York Times, in terms of COVID deaths is quite something. Just a reminder, as of yesterday, 2,600 deaths a day in this country. For those who just sort of want to poo-poo and say, just get over it, which is sort of an astonishing perspective on that many deaths that are happening a day, approximately a quarter of those, apparently, are from people who have been, we don't know for sure, but at least double vaccinated. And we don't know the age of those people, but I would imagine they are older, but it's still important to be careful out there, despite the fact of how much people want to pretend that this pandemic is over. And I want to make it clear, I'm not excited that it's not over.
No, well, I mean, you like the lockdowns. You've been clear about that.
Love it.
Right?
It's so great. I should say it's Will Stancil who did, it was 20% of COVID deaths over the last few months were fully vaccinated. That means at least two. But we have like a 45% rate for the booster, I guess, in this country. And yes, of course, I love it. I mean, it is, there's nothing more fun than to have kids and to have a debate every time you want to do something and to live in a city where it's like one of the things that you like about living in a city like New York is to go places where there's necessarily a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
And that's so much fun. And so I can't wait for this never to be over.
Right.
And which is why I am so insistent upon just pointing out the fact 2,600 people died yesterday because of COVID. Not just like, oh, they had COVID. You know, the way that the parsing.
The denialist
that we've seen where it's like, well, they died of something else. We've had this conversation on this program multiple times. You get the flu. The flu causes you to have pneumonia. You die of pneumonia. Can you say, well, they just had the flu?
It didn't kill them. Well, it's the same thing with AIDS. The parsing of that as well. I mean, you get, people used to say that you can't die of AIDS. You die from the sickness that you get from it. Right.
Right.
Yeah.
And they died of kidney failure, which just so happened because of COVID. And so 2,600 people passed away yesterday.
But the good news is that the case count is precipitously declining.
And Omicron is precipitously declining. You're seeing a similar decline in hospitalizations. I mean, this is what follows. It's just that deaths are a lagging indicator.
Right.
So hopefully in 3 or 4 weeks, we're going to see that number also drop dramatically. Knock on wood. In the meantime, however, when you're aware that this many people are dying, that it's still possible to get COVID if you've been vaccinated, breakthrough infections happen. And I can explain this to people. Like, this is the analogy that I've like sort of settled on now. When my 8-year-old son wants to go outside in October and it's 50 degrees out, it's no longer 60 or 70 degrees out, I say, wear a hoodie, dude. Just put your hoodie on, not just a t-shirt.
Mm-hmm.
Then you'll be warm. When he comes to me in early January and says, like, I'm wearing the hoodie and I'm not warm anymore, I have to explain to him that the weather has changed. So the hoodie is still better than the t-shirt, but now put your coat on. Like, this is like how people pretend to not understand how the vaccine works or why it's changed. Playing clips of people from, 8 months ago or a year ago when they're saying that the vaccine was going to have a certain impact. And now they're liars. It's literally like a conversation I would have with an 8-year-old.
Yeah. It's a straw man. Like they said, they pretend like the left believes that vaccines were a silver bullet, which was not the case whatsoever.
And it's not even like the left. It's just like normal people. Let's be honest. This is just
medical
normal people.
Yes.
Doctors.
Like,
yes.
Right.
Yeah. That's who these people are accusing of fraud on a massive level to like inflate death counts.
The doctors lied. Because COVID wasn't supposed to change. It was supposed to be dipped in amber.
Yeah, and I mean, what they're doing is they know, I think, that knowledge of a novel virus is always going to be provisional and changing. And so they're basically camping out on where they can, those sorts of, I guess, like opportunities present themselves.
And understand where this COVID denialism comes from. largely it is fueled by individuals and groups of individuals and classes of people in this country who want to make sure that we do not have any reason to provide material support for people in this situation. And the Biden administration, certainly it seems to me, is at the very least capitulating to these forces, if not one of those forces. There's been virtual silence. I think they recently made some point about saying maybe there would be some limited unemployment, or there would be some limited benefits that were associated with a sick leave, paid sick leave provisions, or something to that effect. But the fact of the matter is there are a lot of forces in this country, big Koch brother money, libertarian money, conservative money, that wants people to get back to work regardless of what's going on there.
And God forbid they develop a collective understanding of the fact that the government can provide material benefits for them and thus potentially health care as well.
Here is Ron DeSantis, consistent with that, sort of giving up the game here by saying, like, you know, I mean, because if COVID is over, why would we have an eviction moratorium? Here's Ron DeSantis.
Up 30%. And so that's going to cost more on the back end for people. You also look at what the Biden administration did with CDC by having this moratorium where they couldn't, where a lot of the people who own these places couldn't get access to rent. So what they're now.
The eviction moratorium is a problem because a lot of these people own these places. They're not going to have access to rent.
As opposed to access to shelter.
Right. Access to housing, access to a bed for their kid to sleep in. We got to worry about access to rent.
Yeah,
I think there's a weird passive use of that too.
Yeah,
like meaning funds to pay rent, money.
I think it's really, honestly, they just want to adopt the language of rights and, mm-hmm. and
like
you
the
know,
Democrats like, talking about access to care.
Yeah,
we need access to health care. It's them. We need access to rent.
If only.
And not an ability to pay the rent.
Yeah.
To receive the rent.
Like, I have access to a Lamborghini. I could go to a dealership and ask for one, but I don't have the funds to purchase it.
We need access to rent for the landlords.
Also, the CDC did the eviction moratorium when Trump was president.
Yes.
And it was under Biden when that was revoked.
And the funds that were supposed to be paid out to people, it's known as like the most inefficient government program that's that came out of the pandemic. Like, I don't know how many billions were not paid out and how long it took, but there's over $20 billion in rental debt right now. And so, yeah, they use like terms like access in order to obscure the fact that they're in favor of throwing people on the streets.
They could access those funds from the government too, but they'd rather access it from people who need to work.
That's also the point, right? Like, the landlords find it more lucrative to bleed people dry and hang them over a fire pit than to use the government assistance.
We need to allow people access to being evicted. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be playing that interview with Kyle T. Mays, Assistant Professor of African American Studies at UCLA, author of An Afro-Indigenous History of the United States. Just a reminder, if you go to Majority Live now, you will see. In fact, pull that up. Pull that up, Bradley. Let's go to pump it to the URL. Let's see if this worked. MajorityLive.com. You will see the opportunity you have for this to come up on your computer.
You have access
there it is.
To these tickets.
Look at that. Majority Report website. Live show dates and locations. Boston, Mass., May 15th, 2022, 2 p.m., the Wilbur Theater. And now, Brooklyn, New York, March 26th. You know what? I should probably reverse those.
A little bit confusing.
Yeah, I went to the website, actually, and I clicked on the top link thinking that that would be the... And
you know what occurs to me? That is, it shouldn't be in the order that you announced. It should be the order that they're going to actually happen. Now, listen. I want to say this. There's going to be a surprise guest at the Wilbur Show. Or I should say, as of now, there is. One never knows, you know, like, but you're not going to want to miss it. We have, you know, the announcer. Oh, we should probably, I'll put the announced guest in there, too. But Larry Murphy, John Benjamin, Natalie Scherr. There's also a surprise guest. Oh, and I maybe will reveal the musical guest we have, too, in Boston.
The Boston show is getting, like, the all-star treatment.
Yes. Super, super big all-star
treatment. It's Coachella. You're right.
Brooklyn's going to be awesome, too. We'll announce some of the guests at that coming up. But it's going to be, you know, this is our back door, our backyard. Right. So check it out. MajorityLive.com for those tickets. You do not want to miss those shows, folks. Also, don't forget, it's your support that makes the show possible. You can become a member at JoinTheMajorityReport.com. And the AM Quickie, AMQuickie.com. Sign up for it. We have, it's getting a little explosive in terms of subscriptions.
Oh.
I don't mean to be surprised by that, but I'm excited by it.
No, it's great.
AMQuickie.com. Great email in the morning. Tell you the top couple stories you need to know. All right. Quick break and back with this. We are back. Sam Seder, Emma Vigeland on the Majority Report. Joining us now, Kyle T. Mays. He's an assistant professor of African American Studies at UCLA, author of An Afro-Indigenous History of the United States. Kyle, thanks so much for joining us. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Sam. I appreciate it.
Let's start with, I mean, this is, my understanding is this is a relatively new, I guess, look at the relationship between indigenous Africans and Native Americans or African Americans, I guess, black slaves, pre-colonial times, and a history that is relatively unique. What was the impetus for looking at the history of these two peoples and their relationship?
Well, that's a great question. So for me, as an Afro-Indigenous person that is Saginaw Chippewa, there are many stories and books that focus on this particular relationship, but specifically through the five tribes, so the Cherokee, Choctaw, Creek, Chickasaw, and Seminole, right? And so it's a discussion of enslavement, of the five tribes, their enslavement of people of African descent. But I wanted to look at, in particular, the relationship between U.S. democracy as a foundationally anti-Black, as well as anti-Indigenous, right? And understanding the twin oppressions of enslavement and dispossession as foundational to the culture and identity and political nature of this particular society. And so this is why I decided to write this particular book.
So let's talk about that, about that dynamic. Let's just broadly start with that dynamic. Obviously we're talking pre-revolutionary times, and then forward. But let's talk about how that is that apparatus, the building of that foundation, from what perspective first does one look at that? In other words, is it from the oppression takes place for two different peoples, but the oppressor is the same? And so, you know, how does one, what perspective does one take at that point? You know, from the way that the oppression is received or the way that the oppression is deployed?
I think you go from the perspective of people who are oppressed and understanding that history. So for centuries, well up until the 20th century, it was difficult to have voices of Black people, of Indigenous peoples telling their own stories, right? And so to critically reflect on the foundations of this particular history from the perspective of Black and Indigenous peoples is important to tell a broader story and a more critical story about how our particular nation developed. And finally, with that, that'll help us move forward, I think, hopefully in a very critical way of challenging the rampant anti-blackness and anti-indigenous sentiment that persists well into the 2022. So whether that's various forms of blackface or various forms of indigenous mascots or a host of other things, poverty, et cetera, that impact black and indigenous lives today.
Let's talk about capitalism, particularly at that time, when we're talking about the founding, the expansion and the elimination, the genocide of indigenous people, a function of a desire for more land and resources by, settler colonialists, and also the idea of slaves providing free labor for, in some instances, that expansion, and others, with the spoils of that expansion. Talk about how that dynamic.
Yeah, so typically stories of the development of American capitalism begin with either the Industrial Revolution, but ignore slavery, or they begin with slavery and the commodification and exploitation of people of African descent. But what they leave out is that where were they exploited? They were exploited on indigenous land. Right. And so the twin oppressions of enslavement and dispossession are fundamental to American capitalism. And without those two twin oppressions, you then don't have the development, the wealth of American capitalism today. And so modern financial institutions and real estate and ideas of property have been fundamental to American capitalism, but it was based on dispossession and enslavement. And without those things, you don't have the great wealth in society in today. And it's really sad when we discuss the American capitalism. Someone asked me very recently about economy and can Native Americans really thrive under capitalism? And I said, no, because you would have to return the land. And if you return the land, that will disrupt American capitalism at its core.
Well, that's part of what I thought was so interesting about what you wrote, right, is because there's a perception from what you wrote by anthropologists the writing has divided the experience of Black Americans and Indigenous Americans to such a degree that doesn't make sense given what you talk about, because foundationally, both of the exploitations of Black Americans and Indigenous Americans are based in capitalism, yes, but also colonialism and the way that capitalism manifested as a result of that. Can you talk a little bit about those similarities and parallel experiences?
Yeah, so when we're using colonialism in this particular context, I like to be very clear and precise. So we're talking about settler colonialism, and that's a foreign population coming in to settle, they commit genocide, and also they end up displacing, and they want to kill off initially that particular indigenous population, but they're unable to. And it's an ongoing process, right? So whether indigenous lands are in federal trust, whether we have reservations, et cetera. And a fundamental part of settler colonialism is that a large portion of the American population know very little about contemporary indigenous life. And to me, that's one of the saddest parts, in addition to the dispossession of land, is that people know very little about Native people today. And so that is a direct function of how both capitalism to expropriate land, but also to tell people, whether it's in the school textbooks, that indigenous peoples no longer exist, or they exist solely in the past, or the majority live on reservations when in fact the majority live in urban areas. And so in order to continue to justify capitalism today, you have to create these narratives of dispossession that tell people these people no longer exist, which go hand in hand for me.
Right. And then, I mean, and then in terms of the way that Indigenous Americans are presented in culture and in society, I mean, this works well with the news of the Washington football team name change, right? I mean, the you touch on this a little bit, but the mascotting of Native people in this country also, it commodifies Indigenous people, and it also mythologizes them in a way that makes it them kind of places them outside of humanity in the United States, if that makes sense.
Certainly. Like, for instance, most of those mascots or issues are based on the Plains Indigenous Nations, right? And there are 574 federally recognized tribal nations, many state recognized tribal nations, and also tribal nations like the Tongva in LA, where I'm located, who are not recognized, but still have community and consider themselves a particular tribal nation. And, you know, even the mascot issue of the Washington football team, why there were decades of protests by Native people from across the U.S., but why did they finally relent? Because billionaire corporations said, we're going to take our advertising away from you. So Nike and other corporations. And it's a really sad thing. I don't want to negate the activism of Native peoples, right? Like Amanda Blackhorse, who's been doing a lot of things around that very recently. But it took billionaires to say, we will take our funding if you don't do something about this. And that's American capitalism and settler colonialism in a nutshell.
I want to talk about, well, let's also, one of the other themes, and I want to return to the idea of reparations and how that the sort of ongoing negation or, I guess, elimination of the presence of Indigenous people, it sort of plays into reparations. Mm-hmm. But let's go back, because one of the points you make in the book, and at the beginning of the book, in fact, is the failure of historians to contemplate the idea that Africans brought to the United States as, or at that time, you know, to this country at that time, were also Indigenous. So will you talk about that concept of what it means to be Indigenous? I mean, how you have a group of people who are Indigenous on land that is not theirs because they've been forcibly brought from their land.
Yeah, so when I am utilizing a term like Indigenous, there's a legal concept within the U.S., within the United Nations. So within the U.S., it's about recognition from the federal government, which I'm a bit hesitant to always, I think we should try to reject the recognition of the state in some ways. Native nations don't always need the recognition of the state in order to be Indigenous, but within federal law, that's a requirement. Now, according to the Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, Indigenous means people who have a long history of connection to land, of language, cultures, and a host of other things, right? And they're recognized by other groups as such. Now, of course, the United Nations doesn't always have a lot of say. And the United States initially, although they supported NAD, did not support the Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, which passed in 2007. And so when I'm saying Indigenous Africans, I'm not meaning to say that they are Indigenous to the U.S. and therefore are the new Indigenous peoples. But what I'm trying to get people to understand historically is that those people were Indigenous. And if we imagine that they were Indigenous and forced to come to the U.S., similar to Indigenous peoples forced to come from Central America, Salvador, Honduras, et cetera, because of the U.S.'s neoliberal policies, then how can we create better relationships between those two instead of just marking them as Black or African or simply as Latinx or Latine, right? And it's just recategorizing their particular subjecthood so we can have better relations between Indigenous peoples globally.
I see. And so, and is that, But is the definition a function, or is that useful insofar as experientially indigenous people, indigenous Americans who were here, and those indigenous people who were brought from Africa, both were subjected to attempts to strip their relationship to their culture, as it were, or their language, or their history. I mean, in experientially, are they sharing that, and where does that come into play in the context of both what happened at that time, but through the future, I guess, through American history?
Yeah, so there were people like, what I talk in the book are people like the great poet Phyllis Wheatley, Paul Cuffey, who tried to create a settlement on the African continent in the 18th century. But he was the product of a indigenous African and we'll say North American indigenous mother. So his father was a con and kidnapped and brought to the Americas in the 1750s as like 7 or 8 years old. And his mother, and he was able to get his freedom, and his mother was Wampanoag, an indigenous nation that still exists on the northeastern coast of present-day U.S. But for him, because of the rampant anti-Black racism, he began to mostly identify as Black. And, you know, we're Black History Month now, and I've been seeing this as a child, and I didn't know until an adult that he was of mixed heritage, right? So even we see in pre-revolutionary America this racial hatred towards Black people and how those folks, as a result, often describe themselves as Black, even though they continue to be culturally Afro-Indigenous, meaning Indigenous with an African parent and Indigenous with their Indigenous North American mother. So that begins to create the narrative of or the erasure of this Afro-Indigenous identity that in many ways continues well into the present.
Do you have a sense of why Cuffey, who, like you say, was a kin of Wampanoag, why he, was it just in defiance of the anti-Black racism that existed that he identified to the extent that he did exclusively as Black? Or, I mean, what was the impetus behind that? Do you have a sense?
Yeah, certainly it's a defiance against the white supremacy in pre-revolutionary America. And again, within his own family, of course, he identified as sort of an Afro-Indigenous person or Wampanoag, right? But because when he's traveling throughout the Americas and he's seen as a Black person, and this is why he wanted to create this settlement in Sierra Leone, because he was like, why don't we just return back to the African continent, because it is so racist here.
And what is Alauda Equiano? I may be mispronouncing.
Equiano, yeah.
Equiano. What does she bring to this picture?
Well, Equiano, he did one of the first slave narratives that was told from the perspective of an enslaved person. Right. So he is kidnapped as a young person and then brought to the Americas. And it's one of the things that's still taught in high schools, universities. And what he described is his own homeland, right, in very great detail, and also the horrors of the transatlantic slave trade. So he becomes a very important person during that particular time period in discussing the horrors of the transatlantic slave trade and the problems that and the psychological problems that those Africans dealt with, and giving a window to Europeans about the tragedies of that particular trauma.
Let's move forward into where we begin to see movements that that bring together this sort of, I guess, sense of shared identity, or at least maybe sense of shared fate. We see it in the context of, in the progressive era, you write, like in the Universal Race Congress. Is that the first instance where we see, an attempt at a shared movement?
So the Universal Races Congress was held in London in 1911, in July of 1911, and it had people who wanted better race progressions from around the world. So you had people from Japan, you had people from Russia, you had people from South Africa, literally folks from all around the world. And at that particular moment, you had people like W.E.B. Du Bois, the great African-American scholar, and also a fantastic indigenous intellectual, and he is a medical doctor, Charles Eastman, Ohiesa was his indigenous name. And they went to this particular Congress to share grievances that impacted both Black and Native peoples, right? Which is a monumental moment for me in understanding this, the one of the early attempts of Black and Indigenous peoples in the 20th century to find some common ground and to challenge white supremacy and colonialism at the same time. So yes, certainly it's a watershed moment for this particular form of solidarity, and certainly a prelude to the Red Power and Black Power movements of the 1960s and 1970s.
Do we see in the U.S. any implications from the Congress? I mean, how were the ideas that were expressed at that gathering sort of what kind of life do they have in the States at that point or following in terms of any type of movement building?
Well, there was rampant lynchings, continued land dispossession, and a attempt at complete eradication by the U.S. government of indigenous nations. And so the meeting was important, but World War One, where they wanted to have a second meeting, disrupted their attempt to come together. So it always makes me wonder what would have happened if there could have been subsequent meetings around those particular issues. And so it went from focusing on colonialism and race to different nations warring with one another during that particular time period. So, and then it went to focus on citizenship in the U.S. and indigenous rights, and it sort of splintered this particular possibility of Black and indigenous solidarity.
And it's not until the 60s, really, that sort of these concepts be sort of reemerge, I guess, in some a real way in terms of movement building, and particularly with Stokely Carmichael.
Exactly. So Stokely Carmichael, or Kwame Ture, when he would change his name, believed that as a Black person, North America, the U.S. was not his land. It's his indigenous land. And he was probably unique and the only person I've been able to find that consistently stated that point. Right now, he's trying to make a reconnection to the African continent, but he's saying in a meeting he's had in St. Paul, Minnesota in 1974, he says, this is indigenous people's land. This is not my land. And therefore, any form of struggle, any anti-capitalist struggle must center indigenous people's land. And I think it's a lesson for us today to really consider if we're going to be in solidarity with indigenous peoples, if someone's non-indigenous, and how do we center a return to land in our various forms of struggle?
Let's talk about, let's talk about reparations, because I've been introduced, I guess, to two perhaps distinct and perhaps not so distinct concepts of reparations. One for descendants of slaves, and I think we had Sandy Darity on maybe a year ago. I'm not 100% sure. Who, I think, if I'm not mistaken, believes that like there's a monetary figure that I believe was somewhere around $15 to $20 trillion.
Yes.
I've also had conversations with people who believe that in terms of reparations, in terms of indigenous people specifically, that we could start by maybe the national parks that we now consider national parks, obviously stolen land from Native Americans, and return that. But give me your sense of like of both the relationship between reparations for both groups, the necessity for both, if you're going to have one, and your perspective on compensation that comes in the form of money for reparations.
Yeah, so as you articulated, Sam, there seem to be separate conversations that don't overlap at all. And it goes back to the original point I was making, that American capitalism is foundationally based on two issues: the dispossession of land and the enslavement and exploitation of people, right? And if that's the case, these conversations need to be intertwined in a way that says, I don't want reparations for Black people without also returning land or some form of reparations for Indigenous peoples, right? And by having that conversation and intertwining those particular issues, I think it forces us to really consider, do we want reparations in the form of monetary value under American capitalism, right? Because if it's a critique of capitalism, which not many forms of reparations, I don't think really engage in that, right? Do we want reparations from a particular system that continues to harm and oppress Black people, Indigenous peoples, poor peoples in the U.S. and throughout the world? Right. And so do we want this particular system to continue as is? And I think that should be the real question. I'm not saying certainly that the immediate needs of people don't need to be met. Certainly they do. And there's perhaps a way to do that. But foundationally, we should have a greater critique of American capitalism, and not just showing demonstrating inequality, but saying, how do we get out of that inequality? Right. And again, returning land to Indigenous peoples, for me, is the starting point, and not just the national parks, the treaties that were coerced, because we know the U.S. has violated every treaty they made with Native nations. For me, that is justice, not simply receiving a check. And also, the U.S. government ain't given $15 to $21 trillion. I think that's one of the figures to Black people. And so if that's the case, can we imagine something different?
Well, I mean, help me with that, because on some level, I mean, it's interesting, because I think it was I interviewed, I think it was David Troyer, who had a piece in the Atlantic about the national parks. Mm-hmm. And I think once you sort of accept the concept and appreciate the need for reparations, which was introduced to me, you know, as a concept of compensating for slavery, it becomes almost, you know, sort of like obvious that that Indigenous people need reparations as well. But if we're not going to do, and I guess, like, you know, in terms of the land, on some level, if it's not going to be money, let's say, in the context of former slaves, like, what would it be? I mean, how, just, you know, and I, it is, I think the idea of $15 to $20 trillion is unlikely. That's going to, but what's another unlikely thing, I guess, that we can think about, that's important to think about from a conceptual standpoint?
Well, so I think Asheville, North Carolina, Evanston, Illinois, and are particular cases of local municipalities who have offered, they've apologized for forms of segregation, redlining that happened in their particular areas. And their idea of reparations were like giving loans to people and an apology. Loans and an apology. I mean, an apology is always a good start, but it has to be backed by some form of compensation. And so at the very least, and this is you know, something I think many of us can get around. We could cancel student debt for a certain population, and, you know, everyone should be kind of down with that. And, you know, we know student loans impact Black and Brown and Indigenous peoples very differently, although that's something that's impacting all of us. And finding new ways to just fund public education in general, right? But I don't want to prescribe anything beyond that, because, again, I still think land, returning land, as difficult as it might be, is a non-starter, right? And remember, though, and I like to give this point, there was a whole civil war to end slavery. I don't think people often think about that. It took a whole civil war and Black people and their allies fighting for liberation to actually end the a foundational piece of American capitalism. That's important to remember.
I want to also touch on this dynamic, which I was not aware of. You mentioned the five tribes. The relationship between the five tribes and enslavement of African descendants and freedmen at the time. Will you just tell us a little bit about that history and what its implications are today?
Yeah. So in the late 18th, but mostly in the 19th century, you have the United States continuing to encroach on the land of the five tribes. So again, Cherokee, Choctaw, Chickasaw, Creek, and Seminole. And as a result, in order to demonstrate their civilization, they decided, well, let's enslave people of African descent. That's a hell of a way to demonstrate one's commitment to civilization. And that became a way of life for them. And so even after being removed to Indian territory or present-day Oklahoma in the 1830s, they continued that way of life. And so the towns that they built, even in Oklahoma, were built by their enslaved peoples. And during the Civil War, factions of those five tribes decided to join the Confederacy. And they joined the Confederacy because the Confederacy said, we won't take any more land from you and we'll give you representation in our government. Again, that was a faction of those particular tribal nations, because they wanted their way of life, and slavery was a key part, a fundamental part of their way of life. In 1866, the United States made them sign a new treaty that said you can no longer have slavery within your land and nations, and you also have to make the freedmen, the formerly enslaved people within your nation, citizens. And, you know, I'll be very short, but that became an issue throughout the 20th century. It's still an issue today where they're either second-class citizens or non-citizens. Right. And some of those also literally have the blood of their ancestors with them. Right. And so when you hear things like honor the treaties, it's like you should also honor that particular treaty that you sign and do the right thing and make the freedmen citizens of those particular tribal nations.
And so where is that now? My understanding, I believe it was last year that there was some progress in that regard in the Cherokee Nation. Is that correct?
That's correct. That's correct. The Cherokee Nation has ultimately decided, last time I checked, to be inclusive of the freedmen. I think it's the right thing to do, and I hope the other five tribes would do the same. And there's even issues of the five tribes, some of them not willing to give vaccines to the freedmen, COVID vaccine, which, you know, is, it's also a health crisis, right?
Right. That's fascinating. And what are the implications of that? Like, how much does that, controversy, stand in the way of the type of understanding that you are promoting?
Yeah, well, within Black communities, they cause a discord because there's the assumption that Native peoples, like all Native peoples, are involved in the enslavement of people of African descent. And I try to dispel that within the book and in general conversation to say that was these five tribes who engaged in this these acts of enslavement. But it causes a lot of discord, or even something for Native peoples, they'll bring up, you know, something like the Buffalo Soldiers. And I try to just remind them that, yes, these things are tragedies, but if we want to build the world that we want to live in, if we want to dismantle settler colonialism and white supremacy, we have to accept these histories, explore them in order to move forward together. But they it causes discord even amongst these two particular communities well into the present.
And lastly, let's talk a little bit about Standing Rock and the and BLM and I don't know if you would call it nascent or the parallels, but also the sort of the nascent sort of development of this shared understanding.
Yeah, so when Black Lives Matter in 2015 put out their statement in support of the struggle at Standing Rock, it was sort of a watershed moment. And one of the first times that sort of happened since at least the Black and Red Power movement. And you see the rampant support of Black Lives Matter from a variety of indigenous peoples, organizations, increasingly. So for me, the implications are folks are beginning to understand that there's anti-Blackness within Native communities, and there's this indigenous erasure within Black communities, and understanding that, you know, some folks are on their land. And if we're going to move forward and create progress, whatever that looks like, then we must center indigenous land simultaneously in anti-Blackness as well.
Kyle T. Mays, the book is An Afro-Indigenous History of the United States. We will put a link to that at majority.fm. Thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
We are back, ladies and gentlemen. We're going to head into the fun half of the program now.
Whoa. Already.
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess.
12:57. I was reading the about
that
page.
That clock is wrong. It's right.
12:54.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right. I was reading the about page on Majority Report, majority.fm, and it described the 40-minute free show that we would do every day.
And the extra 50 minutes of...
And then the extra 50 minutes of fun half that we would do. Yep. There you go. Folks, you can be part of the fun half by IMing us with the app at majorityapp.com. It is completely free. It is both for iOS and...
Android?
The other one.
Android.
Android.
Right?
Yep. And also, you can call in to the program in just a moment. I will turn on our phone machine, 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920. Just a reminder, it's your support that makes this show possible. Advertising is on the low ebb right now. Not quite sure why. But it is. And so we rely more on our members. And you can be one of those. And of course, as always, if you cannot afford a membership, but you want access to the full show, send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com. Put in the subject line, membership help. We will help you out. Give us a little bit of time. Matt, what's happening on the Matt Lekian Media Universe?
Yeah, among other things, tonight we have Matt Binder on to talk about the scam economy and his this new hit piece fiasco for NFTs where they tried to put Spotify on the blockchain. So Binder will be on tonight.
Whoa.
Patreon.com/Left Reckoning.
Whoa.
I'm so happy that his podcast took off like that. I mean,
he picks his beats well.
He knows his stuff on crypto for sure.
All right. See you.
Well, wait.
We have
a special announcement.
The new MR Fund for Bull Prog.
Oh, right. Bull Prog sent us a new MR Fun Half into the rotation now. We put this, right?
This is MR Fun 2.
MR Fun 2. Let's check this out.
Three. 3 months from now, 6 months from now, 9 months from now. And I don't think it's going to be the same as it looks like in 6 months from now. And I don't know if it's necessarily going to be better 6 months from now than it is 3 months from now. But I think around 18 months out, we're going to look back and go like, wow.
What? What is that going on?
It's nuts.
Wait a second. Hold on for a second. The Majority Report. Emma, welcome to the program.
Hey.
Matt.
What is up, everyone? Nomi Key.
You did it. Let's go, Brandon.
Let's go, Brandon.
Bradley, you want to say hello?
Sorry to disappoint everyone. I'm just a random guy.
It's all the boys today.
Fundamentally false.
No, I'm sorry. Women.
Stop talking for a second. Now let me finish.
Where is this coming from, dude?
But dude, you want to smoke this
7A?
Yes.
Hi, me? Is this me?
Yes.
Is this me?
Is it me?
It is you.
Is this me? Hello, is this me?
I think it is you. Who is you? No sound. Every single freaking day. What's on your mind?
Sports. We can discuss free markets and we can discuss capitalism.
I'm going to go for life.
Who libertarians?
They're so stupid though.
Common sense says, of course.
Gobbledygook.
We fucking nailed him.
So what's 79 plus 21?
Challenge me.
I'm positively quivering.
I believe 96, I want to say.
857-210-3501. One half. 3/8.
9/11, for instance.
$3,400. $1,900.
$3 trillion.
Sold.
It's a zero-sum game.
Actually, you're making me think less of
it. But let me say this.
Poop.
You can call it satire. Sam goes with satire.
On top of it all,
yeah.
My favorite part about you is just like every day, all day, like everything you do.
Without a doubt. Hey, buddy, we seen you. All right, folks.
It's just the week being weeded out, obviously.
Yeah, sundown guns out. I don't know.
But you should know.
People just don't like to entertain ideas anymore.
I have a question. Who cares?
Our chat is enabled, folks.
I love it.
I do love that.
Gotta jump. Gotta be quick. I gotta jump.
I'm losing it, bro.
2 o'clock, we're already late, and the guy's being a dick, so screw him. Sent to a gulag?
Outrageous.
Like, what is wrong with you?
Love you, bye.
Love you. Bye-bye.